This is America on the Road, winner of the International Automotive Media Conference Gold Medal Award for Radio, and now in its 24th year on the air. Thanks for being with us as we bring you the latest automotive information from around the world. In this day's show, we're going to be saying hello to a very hot car, and we're going to be saying a fond farewell to two others. Adios. It's been nice knowing you. America on the Road is brought to you by DrivingToday.com and the Coalition for Vehicle Choice. I'm Jack Nerad. Unfortunately, Chris Teague, our co-host, is not with me today. Chris injured himself a little bit in his home in Maine. He's moving from one house to the other, and I guess he hurt himself. We wish him a speedy recovery, and we expect him to be back with us next week. But I am soldiering on alone, so please be gentle with me as I helm the broadcast all by myself. This week we have a really special guest. His name is Elliot Ash. Really interesting guy. I had a great deal of fun speaking with him. He's with Safe Light Auto Glass, and of course he's going to be talking with us about the process involved in replacing a broken windshield. That almost goes without saying with Safe Light Auto Glass. And it's more complicated than you think, and it's getting more complicated day in, day out. So we'll talk with him about that. We're also going to be talking a bit about the challenges young drivers face when they get into cars and are learning to drive cars with sophisticated new technology. Elliot's job puts him in contact with a lot of this new technology, and he also has a teenage driver in the household, as I have had three. So we will talk with him about that. In the car review segment, I'll be talking about the just-introduced 2021 Nissan Kicks small sport utility vehicle. Vastly improved than before, and we liked it before, so we'll tell you a bit about that in the next segment. Before we do that, though, here is some of the latest in automotive news from around the globe, and we teased that we were going to tell you about this brand new car, and it's a pretty cool one. It happens to be the most powerful production BMW ever, and we're talking about a car called the 2022 BMW M5 CS. It's a refinement of the BMW M5, of course, one of their high-performance sedans. And interestingly, this is a sedan as opposed to a sports car model. And that's, I think, in keeping with what BMW is. It has more horsepower than any BMW ever before, 625 horsepower. It has a redefined four-place cockpit and a lightened body and chassis. So this is a super quick and super powerful vehicle. It's got a 4.4-liter twin-power V8 that makes this 627 horsepower. That's a 10-horsepower increase over the competition model. And you get peak horsepower at 6,000 RPM, which is kind of elevated. The engine's red line is 7,200 RPM. But it has a really broad torque curve, and that is nice. It's a nice for ham-handed drivers like me, for example, who aren't always at torque peak. It uses high-pressure direct injection to generate that flat torque curve. 553 pound-feet of torque. That's an amazing amount of torque. That's like a diesel engine in a big pickup truck. And the torque is available from 1,800 all the way to 5,950 RPM. So you're getting peak torque pretty much throughout. That's 90 RPM wider than in the M5 competition. So this vehicle is all around better than that vehicle we liked a lot, the M5 competition. And it has two oil pumps. So if you're doing high G track competition, you're making those corners and you're not going to starve the engine oil, which is kind of a nice thing. It's not going to run out of oil at the worst possible time. It also uses liquid-to-air intercooling with its twin turbochargers, so it's got really cold, dense air going into this thing, which is why you get 627 horsepower, which is a very, very nice thing. And it's lighter than the M5 competition, to which it's frequently compared. It should be compared. They're using a lot of carbon fiber. This carbon fiber reinforced plastic is in the roof, the hood, the front splitter, the mirror caps, the rear diffuser, and the rear spoiler. This is all carbon fiber stuff. Despite that, though, the car isn't all that lightweight. It's over 4,000 pounds, over 2 tons of romp and stomp and horsepower. But that's 230 pounds lighter than the 2021 BMW M5 competition. So you have that going for you. So it's fast. The important thing is it's really fast. It has a projected 0 to 60 time of 2.9 seconds. That's what BMW quotes for this thing. I'm sure when we get it on the drag strip, we'll cut a tenth of a second off that, or not. This is 2/10 of a second quicker than the M5 competition. It's aided by, of course, its all-wheel drive system. It has an 8-speed Steptronic automatic transmission with drive logic that helps it launch. And launching with all-wheel drive really helps this thing get it done. And if you had a long enough runway, you could get it up to 190 miles an hour. That is the top speed of this vehicle. So all around, we're looking forward to the BMW M5 CS. They're only going to make it for the 2022 model year. It's going to cost about $142,000, and there's a $1,000, $995 destination charge. So step up, sign the contract quick, because I think they're going to go pretty fast in more ways than one. Well, here's another story, and this has to do kind of a turn of the page. It has to do with EVs and EV owners. They are very satisfied with their experience, this according to our friends at J.D. Power, in their J.D. Power U.S. Electric Vehicle Experience Ownership Study that was just released. They like having an EV. They're kind of brand agnostic, and this kind of surprised me. They're much more loyal to the idea of an EV than they are to a particular brand. This despite the fact that people are so incredibly enthusiastic, Tesla owners are so incredibly enthusiastic about their vehicles. Instead, though, what they have found here is that people really want to buy another EV. If they've had an EV, they want another one. I think they're sold on the technology. But they're willing to look at EVs from other brands than the brand that they currently own. And most of them surveyed here own Teslas, because Tesla has so dominated the market. And the Tesla Model S, which is getting rather long in the tooth, it's been out there for quite a long time, still leads in the overall model rankings. It, on a 1,000-point scale, had a score of 798. And the Model 3 was right behind it, the Tesla Model 3, at 790. And those were the only two models that were over the average in the premium segment. That average was 782. And among mass-market models, an interesting relative newcomer leads the pack. It is the Kia Niro EV. It had the highest score, with a score of 782. Chevy Bolt was next at 745. And then the Hyundai Kona EV at 743. And then there were a couple of vehicles that were a bit below the mass market average. The Nissan Leaf, which has been out there the longest. I traveled to Japan long ago to test the Nissan Leaf as it was first introduced, has an index of 712. And the Volkswagen e-Golf 696. Of course, we're going to see a lot more vehicles coming into this market, and a lot more that can be surveyed in coming years and coming months, actually. But the factors involved in satisfaction with EVs are certainly, many things are important, but range continues to be the most important. How far can you travel on a full charge before you recharge the vehicle? That's of critical importance in satisfaction, because it can really limit you if you can't go very far. People also want the car makers to be honest about this. They want to be able to achieve that, as opposed to being promised X number of miles and then they get X minus Y as the real mileage. Typically, the drivers, and this according to the essentially the author of the study, a guy named Brent Gruber, who is the senior director of Global Automotive at J.D. Power, he noted that people don't drive to the edge of their range. They will very often recharge their car overnight. But they still want to know that the actual battery range is very close to what was stated to them. It's about peace of mind, he says, and I understand that. Another thing that was important to note was the fact that the charging infrastructure that Tesla has put together is probably the most important thing when it comes to loyalty to Tesla, even more so than satisfaction with the vehicles. People love the fact that they have this dedicated charging network that they can go to. And so that's been a big boon, I think, to Tesla and to its loyalty. And we'll have to see what happens as we go forward and we see more and more brands get into this business without that the benefit of a dedicated charging infrastructure out there. So that's what's going on. And we told you, and we'll quickly go to this story, about cars that we're going to say goodbye to. There are two cars from Kia. The Kia Cadenza and the Kia K900 are both being canceled. Car cancel culture has killed these cars. And it's a lot of K sounds. But I was around, and my lovely wife were around for the launch of the K900. So we've taken that vehicle full circle there for the launch, and there at the waning days of that particular luxury sedan. And it's actually a nice vehicle now, probably a bargain if you can find a 2020. And the same might be said about the Cadenza as well. So they're going away because, of course, the American market has turned to SUVs, and Kia is going to concentrate on that going forward, on SUVs, and then more and more on electric cars as we go forward. And as we go forward on America on the Road, when we come back, we're going to be talking a bit about, or more than a bit about, you're going to hear probably 10 minutes about the new Nissan Kicks for 2021. So stay with us. Without Chris Teague, this is Jack Nerad with you, and please stay with us right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jack Nerad back with you. Without Chris Teague this week, he is off recovering from a little accident that he suffered, and we expect him back with us next week. We look forward to it. This is road test time on America on the Road, and the vehicle I road tested this week is the 2021 Nissan Kicks. Of course, that's their small sport utility. And that is a really burgeoning class of vehicles. And Nissan has kicked up the ante pretty significantly this time around. New exterior styling. They've refined the interior. And, of course, connectivity is paramount these days, and especially for a vehicle that's aimed at younger buyers. So all that's going on in Nissan Kicks. It has Nissan Safety Shield 360, and we'll describe that a little bit. So this is a vehicle that has a lot of value. It was introduced, the nameplate was introduced 3 years ago as the entry-level model in Nissan's lineup of crossovers, and scored pretty big in terms of sales right away. And now they've revamped it, and they've made some important things standard equipment like Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. That number one really enhances connectivity. They've gone to a standard 7-inch touchscreen, and there's a new 8-inch color touchscreen that's available on the upper two grades, and probably that's where most of the volume of sales are going to be. A lot of exterior styling changes made it, I think, bolder, less cute, probably wise. There is a new 7-inch driver information display in the cluster that's available. Rear disc brakes have been added to the two upper-level trims, the SV and SR grades. And, of course, they have very vibrant colors. The Kicks is known for its colors and their new two-tone combinations as well. Let's dive right into the various models. There is the Kicks S, the Kicks SV, and the Kicks SR. And even in base trim, as I just said, you get Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. You get Bluetooth, streaming audio via Bluetooth, three USB ports, keyless entry, push-button start. This is a kind of a neat feature. It's the easy fill tire alert. When you're filling your tires, which you should do, probably almost nobody does, but you should do, it will alert you when it's the proper tire pressure. It'll give you a little sign, and you should quit putting air in at that point because you don't want to blow up the tires. It also has auto headlights. So this is in the base model. And then going up from there, you get 17-inch aluminum alloy wheels in the SV. They body color the outside door handles. That's a premium feature. You got to like that. And you get roof rails. so that's good, and automatic temperature control. And then the SR is the sportier trim, sportiest of the trims, and it gets LED headlights and some other LED accents, LED fog lights, and black heated outside mirrors because black is sporty. They have integrated turn signals, and you get a leather-wrapped steering wheel, leather shift knob, all the sporty stuff. Leather, I guess, implies sport and vice versa, so you get that stuff. And there is an option package with the SR model that includes Bose audio, 8-speaker Bose audio, and a different seat fabric. It's actually called Primatex. It's essentially leather-like stuff, probably more durable than leather. A heated steering wheel, one of my favorite features, is also part of the package, so gotta like that. And when it comes to fuel economy, well, certainly the Kicks has it. 31 miles per gallon in the city, 36 miles per gallon on the highway, and 33 miles per gallon combined. That might not seem important right now when we're looking at an era of $2 gas, but as things change and administrations change, the gas prices might go way, way up, so maybe that will become more important. I said I would tell you more about Nissan Safety Shield 360, and I'm going to do that right now. It includes automatic emergency braking with pedestrian detection. That's good. You don't want to run into pedestrians, that's for certain. It has lane departure warning, radar-based blind spot warning, a rear cross-traffic alert, which is great in parking lots, then high beam assist, and rear automatic braking that you see advertised in the Nissan commercials so often. So this is a very likable vehicle, and I have talked a lot about this vehicle, and I have yet to talk about the engine or the driving experience, but let me do that right now. And I haven't talked about it because it doesn't seem like the most important thing. Actually, it's all that connectivity and that kind of stuff for this kind of urban vehicle. It seems much more important. But the Kicks is powered by a 1.6-liter dual overhead cam four-cylinder engine. The engine is rated at 122 horsepower, which is not a whole lot in this day and age, and 114 pound-feet of torque. It is connected to a continuously variable Xtronic transmission, and power goes to the front wheels. It's a front-wheel drive vehicle. The driving experience is just fine, and I think will be quite suitable for everybody who wants to buy a Kicks. This isn't a sports vehicle. It's not pretending to be one. Even an SR trim, it's not really all that sporty. For one thing, it just doesn't have enough horsepower to be all that sporty. But it's really pleasant to drive, and it's fun to drive. The interior is upscale of what you would think for a vehicle priced the way the Kicks is, which is a very low-priced vehicle, right around $20,000. So this is just generally a likable vehicle, a likable revision to this vehicle. And I think they're going to sell a ton of them. I just think that this is going to hit home. This is, as I say, a segment that has gotten more and more popular. So overall, we like the brand new Nissan Kicks. We want to spend a little more time in various of the versions, but our first blush drive in this thing says it's going to be a winner. So we have that. And what we have next are your listener questions. So in the next segment, I'll be fielding a listener question or two. So stay with us for that. We wish Chris Teague, our co-host, well as he recuperates. And this is Jack Nerad with you. Thanks so much for being with us right here on America on the Road. Welcome back to America on the Road. This is Jack Nerad back with you. And sadly, without Chris Teague, our co-host this week, who is recuperating, and we expect he'll be back with us next week. So we wish him well as he recuperates, and we look forward to talking to him next week. You know, he's in Maine, I'm in Southern California, and our goal is to help you out. So by sharing information about cars with you. And apropos that, this is listener question time, and I think I've got a very detailed and interesting question this time around. This is from a listener here in Southern California, and he asks, how does a fuel cell vehicle work? Well, it's a pretty good question, and there's a lot to it, and luckily we've got a segment where we can speak about it for quite a bit of time here. You know, when you talk about low emission or zero emission vehicles, the talk is dominated by battery electric vehicles. I mean, we talked in the first segment about Tesla and EVs and the Chevy Volt, all those kinds of technologies, and zero emission, of course. Well, there's another type of electric vehicle, another type of zero emission vehicle, or virtually zero emission vehicle, and that's the fuel cell vehicle. It has a lot of the advantages of a battery electric, and it also has an advantage that battery electrics do not, and that is it can be quickly refueled or recharged, or refueled in this case, in a process that's like filling up the gasoline tank of a regular car, of a conventional car. So it can regain its full driving range in a matter of 5 to 10 minutes, and that's a big advantage versus the lengthy charge times of battery electrics. Of course, batteries and charging is getting better and better. But still, there are instances where the length of time to recharge a vehicle is going to be a problem for you if you're used to just filling up and off you go, recharging or refilling your range and getting essentially unlimited range as long as you can find a gas station. So that's important. The thing and all that sounds great about fuel cell vehicles, they also have limitations. And one of the limitations was creating a fuel cell that was compact enough to power an automobile. That's been solved. We have fuel cell vehicles out there. The Toyota Mirai is among the most recent of them. There's a new version of the Mirai out there. There is also the issue of availability of hydrogen, because that's the fuel that fuel cell vehicles use. And though hydrogen is incredibly available in nature, it's typically combined, it's very common in nature, let's put it this way. It's typically combined with something else. It's very, very rarely found in its isolated state, its pure state of pure hydrogen. And in that state, it's a very highly flammable gas. So there's some dangers associated with it. Usually it's in typically a hydrocarbon, like oil or natural gas. And of course, it's part of water, H2O. So you have that. So hydrogen must be manufactured or processed to use in a fuel cell vehicle, and that's an issue. The current situation is we don't have that many filling stations that can supply you with hydrogen, and that's the big limiting factor in a fuel cell vehicle. Well, that's a lot of deep background on this, but let me talk a bit to answer the question about how a fuel cell vehicle works and how a fuel cell works. Because what a fuel cell does is it generates electricity, it creates electricity by an electrochemical reaction of hydrogen and oxygen. So it generates electricity, and the energy is then used as a battery electric vehicle would use it. The electricity, of course, for a battery electric vehicle is generated outside of the vehicle, and it's stored in the vehicle's battery. It's not creating that energy. It's actually using energy that was generated elsewhere and storing it in those batteries. Fuel cell vehicles don't require recharging like batteries. They continue to produce electricity as long as hydrogen and oxygen are provided. Of course, the oxygen is provided from the air, and then hydrogen comes from the fuel tank. A fuel cell has an anode, a cathode, and an electrolyte membrane. And it creates an electric current by passing hydrogen through the anode and oxygen through the cathode. So bingo, it kind of works like a battery in a way. And the electrons are formed to create an electric circuit within the fuel cell itself. So the only byproducts of this whole process are water, typically in water vapor, and some heat. It has no moving parts. It just kind of functions as more hydrogen and oxygen are provided. It creates more electricity. And then the electricity is used just like an electric car. So these vehicles function and feel like an electric car. When you're driving a Toyota Mirai, for example, it feels as if you're driving a battery electric vehicle. And it uses some of the same technology to do that. So that is essentially what happens with a fuel cell vehicle. And the limiting factor is not the fact, it's not really the technology anymore. I think several companies have proven that you can make a practical car that uses hydrogen and uses a fuel cell to power it. What is limiting this is the infrastructure to provide hydrogen and whether companies should do that, whether that's going to be a good business proposition or not. There was a time, and it's more than 100 years ago, it's more like 130 years ago, when to drive a gasoline vehicle, you had to go to a hardware store to buy gasoline because that's essentially the only place you could buy gasoline. And then businesses sprang up, filling stations sprang up, gasoline stations came to the fore for the all the gasoline-powered cars that were coming into the marketplace. Will we see that for fuel cell vehicles? Maybe we will, and maybe we won't. It's hard to say. Certainly, creating hydrogen or deriving hydrogen is a more complicated and more costly process very often than pumping oil from the ground and then cracking it into gasoline and other products from the crude oil. And of course, that infrastructure has been established for well over 100 years. So that's laying out there for us. And we have essentially very little hydrogen infrastructure. So that is the thing standing in the way of these otherwise very promising, very low emission vehicles that can maybe change the way we drive. Whenever I drive a fuel cell vehicle, I feel like I'm driving a very futuristic vehicle, and they drive wonderfully well. So that is the answer to the question, how do fuel cell vehicles work? And how do fuel cells work? Essentially, they're kind of like a battery under the hood in some ways, but in many other ways, not like a battery at all, since a battery stores electricity, and of course, the fuel cell actually manufactures electricity, if you want to use that term. So when we come back, we're going to be interviewing Elliot Ash. He's with SafeLight Auto Glass. We're going to be talking about a couple of things. Of course, auto glass itself, windshields, and what you do when you get a nick in your windshield. And even more so, we're going to be talking a bit about the all-new technology, some of which requires a clear windshield. So we'll talk, he's an expert on that. And we'll also talk a bit about what teens are facing when they're driving new vehicles with incredibly sophisticated technology. So stay with us for that. This is Jack Nerad with you right here on America on the Road. I thank you so much for being with us, and please stay with us after the break for that interview with Elliot Ash of SafeLight Auto Glass. This is America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jack Nerad back with you, and we have a very special guest talking about an interesting topic. It's fascinating to me, and I hope it will be to you. His name is Elliot Ash. He is the Vice President of Calibration Services at SafeLight Auto Glass. Number one, it's an interesting title, but number two, let me welcome you to the show, Elliot. Thanks for being with us.
Jack, happy to be here.
Well, we're going to dive into your title and what you do in a minute, but one of the things we wanted to talk about today was tech, high-tech vehicles, and our teenage drivers. You have a budding teenage driver, I guess, a 16-year-old. And, you know, I've gone through that with my three daughters who are now 25, 23, and 19 or something on that order. Tell us a bit about what people should be thinking about when they're introducing their children to driving and driving what are much more technical cars than we used to have.
Well, you may have to help me a little, Jack. So this is my first daughter or first child. She's the eldest of the three. And the first one I've had to take through the driver's training and, you know, sit in the class with her, or I'm sorry, in the car with her for, I believe it's 50 hours, driving with her day and night. And it was a lot of anxiety-inducing scenarios we went through. I don't know if it gets any easier the more children you have. Maybe you can help me with that one. I hope it does. The first one was tough.
It really doesn't. And every time they get in the car, you have that, you know, little palpitation in your heart. Even though they're essentially safe and very responsible, that's still something that's concerning, isn't it?
It is. So there are several situations where I wanted to take the wheel or hit the brake, but it's and then she'd yell at me, "Why are you yelling at me, Dad?" So it was fun. I'll put that in quotes.
Yeah, exactly. Fun in a particular way, right?
And my wife wouldn't do it, by the way. She said, "You're going to do this." But your question around these higher tech vehicles and Jack, it's interesting, and I think the from my mindset, and it's different because I come at this from a perspective. I know what these systems are doing, and I know how they help the vehicle drive, and ultimately, you know, what their purpose and is intended for. But you know, teaching my daughter to drive on a newer vehicle that we just purchased for her, it's difficult because I'm teaching her to drive on systems that I have yet to learn myself, other than this new vehicle. Because you know, you think of the rapid change and pace of technology in vehicles. 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, these were all passive systems. You know, they would beep at you. They'd blink these side mirrors. They would kind of just indicate that there might be a problem, but they didn't do anything. And that's the vehicle I'm used to driving. And now we have a new vehicle that's actively trying to do things and augment her driving.
Yeah. For one thing, it might keep you in the lane, for instance, and you know, kind of fight back, you know, when you're steering and do that kind of thing. And it can be disconcerting, I think, right?
If you're not expecting it, yes. And then you think about when you buy these vehicles, and I'm not slamming any dealerships, but they, you know, they may or may not know the true limitations of these systems either. So, you know, you're off, you are on your merry way, and then suddenly the wheel's tugging at you, to your point, you know, to do something different. And you're like, no, I like driving in this part of the lane. And the vehicle says, no, I want to drive in this part of the lane.
So when your daughter encounters that for the first time, what was her reaction? How did she feel about that?
So, you know, she doesn't know any different. This is the first vehicle she has ever driven other than the driver's ed vehicle. She honestly went back and forth. And I'll tell you a scary situation that we had. We were driving down a two-lane country road, and we encountered a bicyclist, which, you know, happens all the time when it's warm. And it's certainly not warm here in Ohio anymore. But when it is warm, you experience this quite a bit. And so off she goes to, you know, I say, okay, it's safe to go around the bicycle. And at that point, the vehicle starts barking back at her, basically saying, you're doing something I don't want you to do. And the vehicle tries to pull her back into the bicyclist. So it's a very scary situation. And as a parent, I had to be very clear and say, you know what? And her name's Alyssa. Alyssa, you are in control of this vehicle. It's not level 3+ autonomy yet, which she has no idea what I'm talking about. But you are in control of the vehicle. You have to, if you believe the vehicle is telling you to do something that's not right, you ultimately have to take control of that vehicle and do the right thing.
And you said that exactly right. I'm wondering how many parents would have that gumption to do that. Children would go, oh, I'm going to do that, as opposed to letting the car, thinking the car is high tech, it knows more than I do, let the car do what it wants to do.
And it's certainly, I mean, it's very clear in every, you know, manufacturer, you read the manual, you're in control of the vehicle. So as a parent, you know, distracted driving is still a thing. This doesn't mean she can sit there and play on her phone because she thinks the vehicle can drive to some extent for her. It's even more scary. And you think about the technology on a vehicle. I made sure we purchased one that has the Android Auto, Apple CarPlay, so I know that her phone is stashed away and plugged in. I track her through apps on the phone, so I can see that her phone is charging as she's driving, which tells me it is plugged in. So I do best I can to say, you know, you are not being distracted and you're driving this vehicle the way you're supposed to.
Right. And you have some location tracking on her probably as well, huh?
Well, you know, as much as she hates it, we certainly, you'll say, well, you know, where are you? Why are you at the donut shop longer than we expected to be there?
What do you think are some of the technologies that might be the most difficult for a teen driver, or for that matter, any kind of novice driver to understand?
Well, I mean, there's the one that she actually likes better now after she's learned how to use it is the cruise control that, you know, has the distance keep from the vehicle
right,
in front of you.
Adaptive cruise control, right.
Yes, which from our studies from at SafeLight, that's one of those love it or hate it type of safety features. You know, I tend to be okay with it. My wife can't stand it because she likes to keep a closer distance to the point where she does not like, you know, let vehicles in front of her. But this system will absolutely keep a long enough distance to do that. So my wife hates it. I don't mind it. My daughter loves it. So things like that, she likes it. It's helping her. It's kind of keeping her a little more relaxed on the highway. It can keep a more constant speed for her and kind of make some of those right moves as she needs it. But the lane keep assist, going back to that one scary feature, that really scared her, you know, where the wheel was tugging at her. So it's taken a little more time for her to get comfortable with the lane keep assist. I would say as a parent, I like this as a safety net. You know, ultimately, I want her to be in control of the vehicle. But so these safety features that the vehicle has, I see them as a safety net. That, you know, if something does go wrong, if for some reason she's not watching the road for a split second, I know that there's kind of this safety net helping augment her driving to an extent. And you know, they're not there to prevent accidents, but hopefully they reduce the severity if there's an accident.
Right. And I guess I'm a little old school, or maybe of two minds of this thing. I mean, certainly I like technology and I like the opportunity for technology to keep us safer than we would otherwise be. At the same time, I'm going, well, geez, if the individual driver can't keep the vehicle in the lane, maybe they should not be driving in the first place, right? Or maybe they're not paying enough attention to what they're doing, where they're bumping into the lane keeping every now and then. What's your take on that?
Well, it's scary. So think forward maybe 5 or 10 years. I mean, this is becoming standard across the board. And by the year 2022, you know, virtually every vehicle that will come out will have automatic emergency braking. And they likely will have lane keep assist right along with that as part of that safety feature or suite of safety features. So moving forward, we can't turn the dial back and say take them away. What's kind of an interesting concept, though, is when they go through driver's ed, that'd be really neat if they teach a child to drive without these features first until they're comfortable there, and then maybe start weaving it in. And that was obviously not part of her regimen, but that would be kind of a neat feature where I ultimately want to know that she is capable of driving a vehicle today. If the system fails for whatever reason, she can do it. If it's not turned on, if she's driving a friend's car, I need to know that she can drive a vehicle and ultimately she can keep control of that vehicle.
Right. My dad actually taught me to drive when I was 13, just in case they needed me to drive. We lived in kind of a rural area. Just in case they needed me to drive for some reason, if there was a health issue or something like that, it was good for a kid of 13 to know how to drive. And of course, it was pretty rudimentary cars that we were driving. It wasn't exactly a Model T, but something like that.
You know, Jack, I'm thinking about the rapid change in this technology too on the vehicle, where 3 to 5 years ago, even 7 years ago, many of these systems didn't even exist on a vehicle. But 5, 10 years from now, I fully see that there could be vehicles that do try to drive themselves. I don't know how children are going to learn to drive on those vehicles if it's trying to do the work for them. So that scares me to an extent. And I have a young son who's 9, and I don't want to think about, you know, what things are going to be like in 5, 6 years when we start looking behind the wheel.
Right. And what's a little scary to me about, especially about level 3 and level 4 autonomy, I guess in level 3 and level 2 for that matter, you as the driver are supposed to take command at at an instant's notice when things are the most dire, when there's a big emergency. That's when you're supposed to take over from the machine and save the day. And that strikes me as a really, really terrible time to have to suddenly take control of the vehicle. What do you feel about that?
It is scary. So I will say I just recently test drove a Tesla, which, you know, is one of the newer vehicles from as far as the technology side. It is a little more advanced than some of the other vehicles. And on the highway, you know, I was using the standard autopilot, not the full self-driving. But even on the highway, on the standard autopilot setting, an off-ramp came up, and I'm staying on the highway. But it tried to pull me under the off-ramp, and that's not where I was trying to go. I mean, even at level 2.5, call it, you still have to stay control. So it is scary, and it's really an odd feeling when the car is telling you, no, I want to do this, and you're saying, no, I don't want you to do that. So it's a scary – this transition for me is a little scary, and then you layer that on top of trying to train our children to drive these vehicles where I'm struggling myself. It just adds a layer of complexity.
Right. Now, one thing I found, and I've had the chance to be at the wheel or behind the wheel of several autonomously operated vehicles now, is the car doesn't drive the way I would like it to be driven. You know, it has a different driving style than I feel comfortable with, whether it's G-loading or how close it gets to things or how far away it is from things. It just doesn't drive the way I like to drive. And I'm wondering if as we go forward, are we going to be able to tailor that to our own liking, or will we just give up and, let the car do what it does?
It's so funny you say that. I was thinking about some sort of you'd have some sort of autonomy road rage where I didn't want to let that car in. Why did you let it in? So you're right. Is there a sensitivity where be an aggressive autonomous driver or be a defensive autonomous driver?
Right.
That's a really good concept.
Well, it sounds like your wife is going to be the more aggressive of the autonomous drivers too.
I this is being recorded, so I got to be careful. I love my wife. we get along very well when we're in a behind the wheel together.
Wisely said. Wisely said. We're talking with Elliot Ash. He is the assistant vice president of recalibration services at SafeLight Auto Glass.
You got it.
Yeah, I'm pretty close anyway. Tell us about SafeLight. Many of us have seen the commercials on TV. It looks like a fascinating service that you provide. Tell us about your company.
Well, we've been in business for many, many years now. And if you think about it, at the end of the day, our role has been to take care of a vehicle and get it back on the road to pre-loss condition when there's glass damage. So whether it's a rock, hitting up on the road, and breaking the windshield to whether it's a, you know, an incident where every piece of glass, you know, is broken out, which, you know, unfortunately happens sometimes. But when that does happen, it's our job to make sure we can do it easy for the customer. We can take care of them. It's a seamless experience, and it's not a happy experience. Customers aren't happy to reach out to Safelite. You know, it's not like you're buying a new iPhone or something you're exciting, like a luxury good. This is a not typically an exciting contact, whether it's to your insurance company or to us. You're not happy to reach out to us, but we do take care of our customers. We make sure it's an easy experience for them. And, you know, ultimately, as fast as possible, they're back in the road and their vehicle's taken care of.
And it seems like you've got this down to a science where you don't necessarily have to go to an installation facility to get a windshield replaced. Tell us a bit about the typical experience.
Well, let's back things up a couple of years, because I think that's a great tie-in to our discussion today. You know, 2 or 3 years ago, we could do mobile service. You know, the vast majority of our service is mobile. We come to a customer's house, or we come to their place of business, which now that we're in COVID, that would mean their house in many cases. But right, we come to them, and we make it super easy, and our customers love this service. Now, with these front-facing cameras and some of these additional safety features being put on vehicles, this changes things. And I almost call it almost a disruptor, if you will. But within our service, many of these recalibrations that need to be performed to make sure this vehicle can track the way it's supposed to track and the safety systems are working properly, they do need to come to our shop now. And in these vehicles, most cases, they need to come to a shop. We will set up in front of a specific target board. We have specific tools. We have specific training for our technicians. But call it a disruptor, the windshield has to be replaced, and now we have to recalibrate in many cases. And this is, like I said earlier, it's not going away.
Right. It's not just replacing the glass these days, because there's things behind the glass that have to essentially see through the glass. And they have to do that correctly, right?
Right. And if you think about any vehicle you're purchasing for yourself or maybe for your child, but it's, you know, okay, I'm thinking my 6-year-old's going to drive this car. She's probably going to scuff a wheel. She may ding a bumper. It's just comes with it. However, these safety features, whether it's the forward-facing camera or a radar unit in the bumper or the grill, it changes things a little bit. And a small repair where maybe it's just a windshield replacement or it's just a bumper cover, that now changes to it may be a bumper cover and a radar recalibration inside the bumper. I mean, so the windshield's the same.
Right, right. And you are the in charge of this, or one of the people in charge of it. Describe to us, our listeners, exactly what recalibration involves.
Sure. So there's two different types of recalibration. There is think of a Subaru, for example. A Subaru actually involves both types of recalibration. So the first phase would be setting the vehicle in front of a specific target board set at a prescribed distance from the manufacturer that the OEM basically states here is exactly how far and how you center it against the target board. You plug the computer of the vehicle using the ODB2 port. You plug that into a tool we use, which sets the vehicle into calibration mode. The vehicle then uses the cameras to look back against the target boards, and it says, great, I see what I expect to see. And these are the new distances that, you know, I'm going to kind of put into my computer and say, this is the center point now of the road, and everything lined up with what it needed to be. So that's kind of the first part of that recalibration, and we call that a static recalibration. Uh-huh. And then a Subaru, in this specific instance, you would then take it out on the road and need to drive this vehicle. And what that will do then, again, it finalizes the recalibration. We call this our dynamic component, which you then drive it on the road, which looking for the lane markers, and then our tool will kind of beep back and say, great, we see what we expect to see, and you are fully recalibrated. So the Subaru is unique because it uses both of those, but most vehicles, you would either do the static or the dynamic. Most vehicles are static. So again, back to customers love it when Safelite can come to their house. It just, we can't do that right now. So until we come up with some sort of solution there to make that easier, a customer does need to come to a branch so we can set it up with the lighting, you know, controlled lighting, controlled environment, controlled level floor to make sure these are done successfully. Can I say, Jack, I am jealous. When I think about myself growing up as a young age, I'm a car aficionado. I love vehicles. And I've always, you know, the Motor Trend would show up and I would read it cover to cover in one day. And as a child, I wouldn't say child, okay, early teens, that was my dream job. I wished I could be one of these test drivers that just got to sit in these brand new vehicles or sports cars. And I'm like, what a neat job that would be just to drive these new vehicles, you know, all the time.
It was. And let me tell you, I was editor of Motor Trend, actually, in the
80s. Were you really?
Yes, I was. So
read your material.
I had that experience. So that was a while ago, but you were probably a babe in arms when I was editor of Motor Trend, but
Probably a little older than you think. But I look at this new Ram TRX that just came out. I'm like, what a cool car to drive, and just to have the opportunity to drive new things like this all the time. Just it seems kind of fun.
Yeah, it absolutely is fun. So where we were recalibrating. Let's get back to recalibrating. Some cars don't need recalibration, correct? I mean, maybe the bulk of them. What percentage of cars do and do not need to be recalibrated as they replace the auto glass?
So if we think of all the new vehicles sold and that we're seeing today, about 76% of those new vehicles being sold today that we see would need a recalibration on top of that. We expect that to be really close to 100% by the year 2022.
Wow, so that many.
I mean, you think of the AEB or the automatic emergency braking systems. These are, you know, most manufacturers, actually they all have signed up to say, you know, we will make this standard by the year 2022. And they don't typically just put the AEB or the emergency braking systems on. They usually come with a larger suite of safety features. So, you know, Honda, I think they call it a Honda Sense system. I mean, that's coming standard on all but maybe the LX and a few other vehicles. So it's becoming standard on even the base trims of most manufacturers. And by the year 2022, we expect, you know, virtually all manufacturers to have some sort of forward-facing camera or feature that could do it for that.
And these are camera systems as opposed to LiDAR or radar or something like that. Do you also deal with that?
We do see them. I'm sorry to interrupt. We do see that. We do see sometimes these systems talk to each other. But you know, when you think of the cruise control systems that, you know, will help the vehicle stop or, you know, maintain a distance, a lot of that is done through radar or LiDAR. A lot of the lane keeping assist systems, a lot of that is done through the camera-based systems. But we're seeing more and more of these systems are starting to talk to each other. So there could be a point in the future where if one system is recalibrated, you may need to recalibrate a secondary system. So, you know, something we have to keep an eye out for at all times.
Right, right. What should the average consumer know about their windshield, the other auto glass that they have? Are there specific things that people just should know or are doing wrong that they could do better?
Well, I'm going to give a very simple tip, and it's going to sound very stupid, Jack. There's nothing better than when cleaning the inside of the glass. You know, as much as people spend cleaning the outside, there's something about cleaning the inside of the windshield. So that's probably not your question, really, but I just tell you that
it's a great answer because the inside of the windshield always seems to be dirtier than the outside. And I think it's largely because it's easier to clean the exterior of the windshield than it is the interior, right?
You have to reach across the dashboard. You know, I'm getting old. My back hurts when I do it, but it's something simple that makes you feel good afterwards. But as far as keeping the glass from breaking, you know, obviously the distance you keep from larger trucks that are in front of you. We're here in the Midwest where we do get a lot of snow and ice. And you know, we warn our customers, do not put hot water on your car when there's ice on it. You know, be careful how you get the snow off. Don't pound on your glass. If there's a small chip in your windshield, make sure you take care of that as soon as possible because that will eventually spread into something larger. So there are some tips out there to keep your glass, you know, from either breaking farther or breaking whatsoever. But the key is if it does break, get it taken care of as soon as possible, and you might be able to salvage a repair as opposed to a replacement.
And how does that chip repair work? It seems like magic, and I know it's not magic, so you could probably describe to me how it works.
So you think about the glass itself. We have a proprietary repair system where it will create a vacuum-like set up for the vehicle, and then it will inject the resin, which the resin will then harden through incurred through UV light and create a rock solid bond as if it was, you know, original glass. So the repair is not designed to get rid of the damage whatsoever. It still may look like a bug splatter or something, you know, a small blur there, but it does create the structural rigidity that you'd expect in that glass and prevent that crack from spreading further. So it is a great alternative. It saves glass from having to go to the landfill. It saves you or your insurance company money. So it's a great alternative to having that glass, you know, ultimately cut out and replaced. But, you know, if it does crack beyond the size of a dollar bill, or we're now saying because of recalibration need, if the crack is in the line of sight of that camera, in that situation, it would need to be replaced.
What else should people know about Safelite Auto Glass or just this in general before I let you go, Elliot?
Well, I'd say again, as a parent, maybe teaching their children to drive or looking at vehicles that have these safety systems, I would say it's up to the consumer or the person purchasing the vehicle to really do the research on what these systems can and can't do. You won't always get the education you expect to get when you go to the dealership. They may not be able to explain it to you very well. You know, you may not really understand it until you're out on the road, and therefore, you know, if you buy a car for your child and you're saying off you go and you're not really training them on it, it could put them in a weird situation where it's contradicting what they think is the right thing to do as a driver. And what's funny is, as a parent and someone who myself has only driven these vehicles in the last couple of years myself, it's a change to our reality. It's a change to what I've been driving for 30 years. To get into a vehicle now, and it's telling me something different. No, you're not supposed to drive there. You're supposed to drive here. Here's when you're supposed to start braking. So it's a learning curve. And then, you know, so getting our children involved in this learning curve that we're still on, I would say it's up to the driver of that vehicle and the purchaser of that vehicle to do that research before you get, you know, behind the wheel of one of these vehicles.
Well, that is excellent advice. Excellent advice. Elliot Ash, he's Assistant Vice President of Recalibration Services at Safe Light Auto Glass. Thanks so much for being with us. I really did appreciate it. It was fun to talk to you. Appreciate it.
Jack, it was great speaking with you as well. And, you know, if you could send me a sound clip of someone peeling out in TRX, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Okay. That can be done. Actually, it might even be me. So great to talk to you. I hope we can chat again.
All right. Thanks, Jack. Care. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you. You too. And stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back right here on America on the Road. And that was our interview with Elliot Ash. He's with Safe Light Auto Glass. I think interesting stuff. Very interesting guy. I love talking with him, and we thank him so much for being with us. We can't wait till Chris Teague, our co-host, is back with us. I think he'll be back with us next week on America on the Road. I would like to ask you, if you like the show, please pass it on to somebody else who you might think would find it enjoyable, you know, another car aficionado out there that you know, a car guy or gal or whomever you might think enjoy this program. We'd love to have you pass it on. I'd also love to have you check out my latest book. It's called The GR Factor, Unleashing the Undeniable Power of the Golden Rule. It's available from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, at local bookstores across the country. Please check that out. We absolutely subscribe to the golden rule around here. Our goal is to help you as the listener learn more about the car industry, learn more about cars, and just have a better day. So we love to have that happen for you. And we hope we can do that for you again next week right here on America on the Road. This is Jack Nerad with you, and I hope you join us again right here next week as we give you another installment of America on the Road right here from Driving Today.